We'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Clerk will take the roll. Obviously, at this point, we do not have a quorum, but as I had stated earlier, we do mean to start on time, and so we will start with our testimony, and when we achieve a quorum, if ever, we will officially come to order and proceed. So we do have a very full agenda today, members. But we ask interested utilities that do business in the state to come in and briefly give us an overview of their operations and service territories, etc., and also to give us kind of a preview, and obviously we're going to be discussing these issues at length as the session goes on, but to just give us kind of a preview of the issues of concern to them in the upcoming session. So first on our agenda, and I should mention that the way this has worked out, we have asked presenters how much time they needed. They told us. I will remind them of that as they come to testify so that we do have time to hear from everyone. And first on the list is Deborah Burgum from Missouri River Energy.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Hilty, committee members. I will try to keep this under 3 or 4 minutes, just to give you a brief overview of who and what we are. My name is Deb Bergen. I'm the manager of state legislative affairs for Missouri River Energy Services. Our financing affiliate is Western Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, which is a Minnesota municipal power agency and entity. MRES, as we're called for short, is based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We are made up of 60 members. All 60 of those members are municipal electric utilities. And these are members are in the states of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. Of these, Minnesota has 24 communities. MRS also has 21 associate communities, 19 of which are also in Minnesota. I want to start off today with just a general analogy of what utilities generally do. If you imagine a water tank, draw a red line about 2 inches down from the top of that tank. Now fill that tank with water. That's energy. Now if you imagine one hole in the bottom that takes water out at a regular rate, and a second hole that takes water out at intervals, irregular intervals, now imagine 200 such holes taking water out of that tank. Your job, or my job at the utility, is to keep pouring water in the top of the tank to keep the water level at that red line. And that's what utilities do every day 24/7. We need to keep energy equal to demand. We need to keep pouring water in that tank so that that line is at that same level every second of every day in order to meet demand. As to Missouri River Energy Services directly, what binds our communities together and the reason we have our name is that all but one of our communities receives an allocation of hydroelectric power from the federal hydroelectric dams located on the Missouri River. Each community has a municipal utility that provides power and distribution services to its residents and its businesses. Missouri River Energy Services manages the long-term power supply contracts for these municipal electrics, as well as providing additional power supply, transmission, and other resources to these utilities through assets that we own through Western Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, our financing affiliate. Although we are not subject to rate regulation due to our status as a political subdivision, we do participate in the Minnesota Integrated Resource Planning process. Also, we have a long history of aggressively pursuing environmentally responsible generation resources while also providing reliable and low-cost electricity to our member communities. For example, Western Minnesota has long held a 16% share of Laramie River Station, a coal-fired electric generation facility located in Wheatland, Wyoming. It burns low sulfur Powder River Basin coal and remains one of the cleanest, most state-of-the-art power plants in the nation, despite being almost 3 decades old. Laramie River Station provides approximately 281 megawatts of power to the MRAS member communities. Missouri River Energy Services also strongly supports renewable energy and has promoted its member use of wind power for a number of years through its River Winds program. We own 4 turbines located near Worthington, Minnesota, with a total capacity of 3.6 megawatts. Our customers can purchase this power through the River Winds program. Missouri River Energy Service also aggressively pursues good faith efforts to comply with the state's renewable energy objective, despite a number of setbacks. For example, we have planned to construct a 1.65 megawatt turbine near our Worthington facility back in 2005, but unfortunately, changes to the renewable energy production incentive that year made financing the project problematic. And then subsequently, we had a landowner issue which would not allow us to build on that site any longer. So we lost that site. We also support the passage of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which included the establishment of seabed projects, or community-based energy development. Almost immediately, we partnered with a seabed project near the Marshall, Minnesota area for 10.3 megawatts. But unfortunately, we lost our equity investor and was not able to resurrect that project. But had it been completed, it would have put us well beyond our REO obligation back in 2007. Despite these setbacks, we've continued to research more wind projects and are continuing to do so today. And we remain committed to renewable energy development and will continue to pursue renewable energy projects to suit our members' needs. Thank you for your time. I'm open for questions, if any.
Questions for members? So, Ms. Bergen, apparently we have no further questions for the moment. We hope to see you in the future, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman.
We have next on the agenda Otter Tail Power, Lauren Bogtag. Bogtag,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the committee.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Lotzog. I'm with Otter Tail Power Company, and I'm here today to speak on my company's behalf regarding the issues before us on House File 4. Otter Tail Power is an investor-owned utility in western Minnesota. We are headquartered in Fergus Falls, and we serve western and northwestern Minnesota. And we serve about 150 small towns, including the cities that you may know of, our Crookston, Bemidji, Fergus Falls, and Morris. And we serve a lot of small towns that have 100 or 200 or 300 people. So we're kind of we're the small investor-owned utility in Minnesota. Otter Tail Power is interested in renewable energy. We plan to do a lot more renewable energy, and a lot of it's going to be wind. In fact, for those of you who don't know, we own a small wind tower manufacturing company that's headquartered in West Fargo, North Dakota. And the last couple of years have been very good for what's a company called DMI Industries. And the wind tower business has been good ever since the production tax credit was reenacted at the federal level. So we think wind is good. In Otter Tail, every 2 years, each utility in the state has to file what's called an integrated resource plan. And in that plan, we have to forecast out quite a number of years and predict what we think we will need to serve the needs of all of our customers. And in our most recent integrated resource plan, we do modeling. Every utility does modeling to arrive at results. And our model has suggested to us, and we filed this with the commission, that we need 115 megawatts of new baseload coal, which we will get if the Public Utility Commission approves our application for a certificate of need for transmission in Minnesota. The application for approval of the transmission goes with the Big Stone Timber Power Plant, which is a supercritical pulverized coal plant that will be built on Big Stone Lake in South Dakota. But in addition to 115 megawatts of baseload coal, our integrated resource plan also suggests that we need up to 160 megawatts of wind energy. Wind energy has become very cost competitive, and if you just look at those two numbers, 160 megawatts of wind versus 150 megawatts of coal, that means that our wind requirement or wind numbers will be almost 40% greater than our baseload coal number will be. So it makes sense for us economically. We are committed to doing a lot more renewable energy and especially wind. Now, on behalf of my company, I just want to express a couple of concerns that we have with some of the specifics regarding House File 4 and the times involved. Our biggest concern is the year of implementation. We're not as worried about whether we've got a good faith renewable objective or a standard, but we are concerned about the year. Last year at this time, we were considering a 20 by 2020 renewable bill. Actually, it was almost exactly the same as Representative Peterson's bill is today. And in that debate, we did not mean to communicate to anyone that we don't support renewable energy. We were also not mean to communicate to anyone that we can't achieve 20% renewable wind, renewable energy by 2020. What we were saying a year ago is we simply wanted the legislature to delay a year to make this decision until the Public Utilities Commission had finished its wind integration study. Ken Wolf from the Public Utilities Commission was here last week and shared the results of the wind integration study. And the result of the study that's probably most key is that we think we can do 25% wind and integrate it safely and reliably into the transmission and generation grid in this region. So today, we're really here to say we support renewables. Last year, we said 20% by 2020. The governor has suggested maybe 25 by 25. And so I think the bill here has been adjusted today to say, well, how about 25 by 20? We're concerned about the compression of the goal by 5 years, and for a couple of reasons. First, there are issues related to cost that can be unknown at this distance. And an example of this was about a little over a year ago, we saw a near doubling of the price of wind turbines. That was a temporary event, although prices are certainly not back where they were before that time, but a significant increase in the cost of turbines occurred because of the shortage in turbines. This is just one example of the kind of thing that can happen as an unintended consequence, that if you have a standard or a mandate in place and it requires that you meet that, then there need to be appropriate flexibilities at the commission to deal with those challenges. I would also point out that in terms of time, there was a handout yesterday at the Senate hearing like this from Mr. Bill Grant of the Isaac Walton League. And by the way, the utilities have been meeting with a number of the environmental groups in Minnesota, and we're discussing common ground and trying to find a way through some of the details here. But Bill Grant passed out a spreadsheet that I'm sure is available to the members of the committee at any time from Bill. And there was an option there for 25% by 2020 versus 25% by 2525. And if you think of this as a fraction or a ratio, it's basically 25 over 100. And that 100% on the bottom of the fraction grows with time because all of our loads are growing as time goes on. Otter Tail power is growing at about 2% a year in Minnesota. And I think some of the other utilities are growing quite a bit faster than that. But one of Bill's scenarios that was laid out there was a 2% growth rate. which I think would be very typical, if not conservative, for the state of Minnesota. In the spreadsheet he handed out, if you do this in 2025 instead of 2020, you have a larger base on the bottom to work off of. And 25% of the number in 2025 is actually 700 megawatts larger than the megawatts of renewables that would be required in the year 2020. So one reason I think the committee should consider waiting until 2025 is you actually get more, 700 more megawatts of wind or renewables out of the deal.
Mr. Lontag, I thought you were making an argument for 2015.
I was actually making quite the opposite argument, that the longer you wait, the more you get. The other things I'd like to talk about are what we call the off-ramps with respect to what happens if we encounter challenges that are beyond the control of the utilities that are required to meet the standard. First of all, what if price for some reason gets out of hand, becomes unreasonable? What if the federal production tax credit is done away with and we don't have 1.9 cents a kilowatt hour to contribute anymore? Then we think the commission should have the flexibility to consider that and incorporate that into its overall decision with respect to how do we implement the renewable energy standard for each utility. The second issue we have is with reliability, and this is simply a matter of, we have a study, a wind integration study, that suggests on a theoretical basis that yes, we can integrate up to 25% wind into our system, but in real life, not everything works exactly as you model it. So if we encounter difficulties that are reliability related, then what can the commission do to provide flexibility? One of the things that we sell along with kilowatt hours is we sell voltage stability. I used to be a customer rep who went out and called on industrial customers. And industrial customers, the business today, have a lot of equipment that is very voltage sensitive, even to very small fluctuations in voltage. And if for some reason we thought that the wind that we were implementing was affecting our transmission system in a negative way and affecting our customers, we would like to be able to discuss this with the commission and ask for some time to deal with that issue. The flexibilities are really more time delay issues than they are with letting us out of it. It's not like pulling off at an off ramp on the highway. If there are regulatory barriers that we haven't been able to resolve through no fault of our own, then that's something that should be considered by the commission. And finally, just simple transmission access. If you build a wind project out or near the Buffalo Ridge today, then in the process of doing that, you need to go to the MISO, the Midwest Independent System Operator, and ask for permission to access the transmission system. And you would be just anybody who went to Buffalo Ridge asking for more access to the transmission system for renewables or any source of energy today would be told no, it's just not available. In the CapEx study, there was a suggestion that we would build, the CapEx utilities, of which Otter Tail is a member, would build at least 600 miles of new transmission. This would accommodate roughly 6,000 or 6,500 megawatts of new load that we see between now and 2020, of which between 3,000 and 3,500 would be for renewables. Taking this figure from a 10% REO to a 20 or 25% renewable energy standard, CapEx estimates somewhere in the range 1,800 miles of new transmission lines will have to be built. It will take time and money to invest in that transmission, and again, we would appreciate the legislature's consideration of both time and financial constraints in terms of the year of implementation. Mr. Chair, this concludes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lugtug, about the transmission question, 600 miles of new transmission for the existing standard we have now, or objective, is about 600 miles. And the same question to tripling that. if we go up. Are we talking about brand new routes, brand new location site? Are we talking about more miles of cable pulled in existing corridors, upgrading the capacity of existing transmission lines and distribution network and so on and so forth?
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee,
still have time.
The 600 miles of transmission lines includes primarily new corridor transmission. Most of these lines are fairly large lines, 230 kV and 345 kV. It's very likely that the majority of those, the rest of the lines that would make 1,800 miles would also be large lines, 230, 345, although there is inclusion in the plan of some 115 kV lines as well. Now, let me add that Otter Tail Power does plan to involve itself more thoroughly in seabed community-based energy development. And there's some discussion that some of this can be mitigated, the need for new transmission. And at a micro level, that's true to some degree. But at the more macro level, in the end, you need to deliver it long-term somewhere to some customer. And it takes, at some level, it takes bulk transmission to do that, and that involves 230 and 345 kV lines.
Further questions, members? As I assume most people are aware at this point, we will be taking up House File 4 next week, beginning a discussion, and of course, most of the concerns that you have mentioned are directly relevant to that and other issues that we'll be considering. So there will be opportunities, I'm sure, for further discussion. We just wanted to get kind of a heads up today. So we appreciate your testimony, Mr. Logtug, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you in the future.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
And members, we did over time manage to accumulate a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order, and we should dispose of the matter of approving the minutes. Representative Peterson, I think you probably have studied the minutes to your satisfaction. And Representative Peterson moves the approval of the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, the minutes are approved. And Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for the last testifier, Mr. Lawdog. And I have a question about your production facility for manufacturing the wind turbines. Is that facility running at capacity now, or how's that going?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, the facility is located in West Fargo, North Dakota, and it was originally a facility that was used for manufacturing beet harvesting equipment. And in search of a new mission, they came upon, let's make towers for the wind industry. And that proved to be a very good business for a while until the federal production tax credit disappeared and the wind industry essentially came to a halt for a while. We were kept alive by the Canadian wind industry. It has been through a couple of expansions over the past 3 years, and it employs about 400 people. DMI also owns a facility in Ontario, and it manufactures wind tower equipment. That facility also employs another 200 or 300 people.
Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, not a question for the witness, but just what you had commented about the House File 4. Would be starting next week. Do you expect amendments maybe by Wednesday and finishing it up sometime next week? I assume it has to move to other committees. No. Or what do you foresee for a timeline of amendments in that bill moving to another?
Western, the first hearing on the bill will be next Wednesday. on Monday's agenda is MISO and some of the transmission issues. So we'll be taking the bill up on Wednesday, and would expect that there would be more than one hearing on the bill, possibly both Monday and Wednesday of the following week, but certainly on Monday. So I would say probably the following Monday would be when we would be taking up amendments.
Okay. And that bill will have to go to other committees, probably, Mr. Chair?
I'm not entirely certain that it does need to go to other committees, Representative Westrum.
Okay. Thanks.
Next on our agenda, we have Minnesota Power.
Thank you, Chair Hilty.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hilty and members of the committee. I'm Margaret Hodnick, and I'm the Director of Regulatory and Public Affairs for Minnesota Power. And what I'd like to share with you today is some information on who Minnesota Power is and some facts about our utility. And I'd also like to share some thoughts with you on renewable energy, since we know that's the big topic, and we've been discussing it with our folks in the Senate, so we thought we'd talk about that a little bit. Minnesota Power is, and we've got some handouts for you, this first sheet, is an investor-owned utility in northeastern Minnesota, and our service territory runs roughly from International Falls to Brainerd to the Duluth Superior area. So that Arrowhead region down to near Little Falls is where we serve. And we have about 130,000 customers, and we're a very unique utility actually nationwide, because Minnesota Power has about 60% of its energy sold to large industrial customers, paper mills, taconite mines, and pipelines. Most utilities have their energy sold in a more uniform way, where 30% is residential, 30% is commercial, and 30% is industrial. But we're very weighted to that industrial side. And the reason that that's important is that economically, those industries employ thousands of people in our region and indirectly are responsible for the employment of thousands of others. And so the well-being of those industries and the operations are very critical to our whole regional economy, as well as Minnesota Power's well-being. And anytime we make an energy policy change that has an economic impact, those companies are usually hit pretty hard with that economic impact. We're concerned about any changes to any of our customers' bills, but we particularly are concerned about those because they employ so many people in the region and they're so vital to the region's economy. And another thing that's unique about those customers that I want to point out to you is that they take large quantities of energy 24 hours a day. They run very large mill motors grinding taconite or producing paper. And oftentimes the utility will have a load that starts out low in the morning and gets high during the day as it goes along, as people turn on air conditioning or businesses come up to speed. Minnesota Power never sees that kind of a rise and fall in its load during the day. Our load is like this 24 hours a day. It's just steady because of the demand of these industrials. And the reason that that's important is that if you've got a load profile like ours that's even like that and high running, you need a lot of energy 24 hours a day, whereas other utilities need less energy typically at night and later into the evening. Minnesota Power has what's called a high load factor, so there's strong demand all day long because of those customers that I mentioned, the large ones. In terms of our supply, we're currently largely a coal-based utility. About 90% of our generation is coal. We have some major emission reduction projects going on that you may have heard about. Some of them came through courtesy, we're planning to do them anyway, but the mercury bill last year helped them in terms of supplying a form of cost recovery that we appreciated. But we currently operate at 70% below our federal permits, and these new emission reduction plans that we're going to be implementing will take us to the new requirements, both of the Minnesota Mercury Bill and some federal requirements. So we will be making some major investments there. We've got about 100 megawatts of hydro on our system. We're the largest hydro supplier in the state of Minnesota, and we began as a hydro utility. And we have made The additions that we've made to our energy supply since 2000 have been renewable. They've largely been biomass projects, and biomass projects we have unique opportunities to do because we have so many paper customers on our system, and we can work with them to either take excess wood off of their system and run biomass plants using that, or sometimes there's excess steam that is in those operations, and we can use those to turn a turbine, and so that's an effective biomass project. And the good thing about biomass energy is that it's a high load factor energy, so it meets that steady high state requirement that I described to you that our customer load needs. We also have added wind energy to our system, and we're planning to add more, and we think there's a place for wind energy on our system. We've got a project that just launched in North Dakota, a new one that's going to get started there, and we've actively been searching out projects in northeastern Minnesota and near the Little Falls area, both for conventional larger wind projects, and then the community-based energy development projects that are were referred to earlier, I think, by Lauren Logtug. So we have those going, and we also plan to add 10 megawatts of hydro energy at our Fond du Lac hydro facility. There's some water that's essentially just spilling right now that we can capture effectively with a turbine, so we can add renewable energy there through the hydro system. Our philosophy on renewables is that we're adding them, and we plan to add more. When we add them, though, we always look at three criteria, and the same criteria we look at for any addition that we make to our energy supply. One is cost, one is reliability, and the third is environmental impact. And we believe any sound energy decision will always balance those three criteria, because we feel we have a responsibility to our customers to deliver them the right energy supply at the right price and do it consistently. And so in any energy decision we make, whether it's renewable or otherwise, we're looking at those three criteria. We want to diversify our portfolio. I told you we're a majority coal utility. We'd like to add renewables to diversify our fuel mix, so that's one reason also that we want to add renewables. And right now I'd just like to make a couple comments on what we think is fundamental for success with renewable energy. I told you that we're adding wind, and we plan to add some more wind supply. And there's a lot of talk about wind. In fact, that's the renewable that everyone's the most familiar with, and we think it's a good one. However, with the load factor that we have, the high and steady load factor, the fluctuations that come with wind energy and the unpredictability of wind energy make it not the best match for a system like ours, because we have that high load factor. When the wind isn't blowing and there isn't wind available, we've got to fill it in with other sources of energy. And other utilities would have to do this too, but Minnesota Power would have to do it to a larger degree because of the high load factor and the fact that we don't dip down during the day or in the evening as some other utilities do. So we want some wind, but I can tell you that the energy that we need is baseload energy in the majority, and so we're looking for baseload renewable energy as well as wind energy for our system. And so biomass projects are very important to us. Heat recovery projects, I passed some information out to you on that. It's something we're looking at right now. These two sheets, this blue set of slides, and then this attachment that describes heat recovery energy. It's another opportunity with our industrial customers to take product off of their system and use it to turn a turbine, just like waste wood is used to be burned and turn a turbine. Here we're capturing waste heat. We would be using it to heat thermal oil, and the thermal oil would then vaporize a fuel like pentane gas, and then that gas would drive a turbine and produce energy on site at an industrial customer. And we just completed a study that we had done with LHB Engineering in Duluth, looking at opportunities throughout our service territory to produce energy that way, because it would capture this waste heat and make electricity with it. And we believe that that's a form of renewable energy that should be qualified. Currently, it's not in the renewable energy objective as a qualified form of energy. When the renewable energy objective was designed, we weren't even thinking like that. The technology wasn't there, but it is there today, and so we're very interested in that, and that's something that over time as we talk with you more, we'd like to tell you more about and consider. We're concerned when it comes to talking about adding renewable energy that we would be able to get enough energy at the right price and the right reliability to meet a standard of 20% or especially 25%. Again, given our load factor on our system and given the kind of energy that we need, we're not sure that at all that we could find certainly 25% by 2020, as some people are suggesting, at the right price and at the right reliability to serve our system. And we're willing to try. We've got projects lined up. We've been studying it. We're working on it. We would like to get to add as much renewable energy as we possibly can. But we think it's important that cost and reliability be considered in that balance. And as part of that, another handout that I gave you is this diagram that says across the top, proactive renewable planning via utility resource planning process. And the reason that we're sharing this with you is that in our discussions with the Senate and with other people that are interested in renewable energy, we thought it was important to let everyone know that there are processes right now for utilities to add renewable energy to their system through the renewable energy objective, which is described over here and what the key factors are under that process, but also that that process is woven into the overall resource planning process, which is diagrammed in the middle of this handout that I gave you. And the resource planning process looks at renewable energy, it looks at non-renewable energy, it looks at transmission, it looks at conservation, it looks at the whole picture of energy supply in Minnesota. And we believe that to make the right decisions on energy supply, it's important to keep both the renewable energy objective process in place, however it evolves in legislation that might happen in this session. Keep that in place, a renewable energy process, but ensure that it's part of resource planning, incorporated into resource planning, so that the best overall decisions are made for energy supply in Minnesota. And we're not sure that everyone is as familiar with these processes as we are because they don't work with them every day. And so we thought it would be helpful to just share with the committee a diagram of what this looks like. And on the very far right is the stakeholder process, where anyone who's an interested party can weigh in on the resource planning process and make comments about renewable energy or anything else. And so we ask as you work on legislation that you keep this process in mind, because we think the best energy decisions come out for Minnesota when all the factors are looked at and with these processes that have been proven and used over time. And in closing, I guess I'd just like to say that we hope as we go forward in our dialogue with you and as you do your deliberations and development of legislation that you will recognize that each utility is unique in its customer makeup, in its load, its access to energy supplies, the state of its transmission grid, and its load characteristics. And I tried to share some of that with you about Minnesota Power, and that it's very important to, we feel, to develop legislation, if it's to promote renewable energy, that it takes all of those things into account so that we end up at the end of the day with the right price, the right reliability, and the right environmental benefits for the customers that receive the energy. And with that, I'm closed, so I'll open any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Sadnick. And we do have questions, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Sadnick. I'm extremely interested in the cogeneration, the waste heat recovery, and I didn't know that the study is a new thing to me. So I'm very interested, and I'm wondering if you can at least one request and then some more information, I guess, but if you could provide, if you're at liberty to provide some more information beyond what you have here in terms of what, well, let me just stop there and ask you that question first.
Well,
Ms. Hodden.
Chair Hilty, thank you, Representative. The first thing I'll tell you is that I'm not an engineer, so I won't be giving that level of explanation or information about this, but we commissioned a study through an engineering firm to look at waste heat recovery processes and how they work, and to also look at opportunities in our service territory for applying them. And the types of places that have been studied are taconite mines, paper mills, mineral supply places, and gas distribution pumping systems, just as examples. And these would be projects that are like 5, 10, 15 megawatts in size, typically at industrial. And I'm talking about industrial facilities, but my understanding is that you can also capture waste heat from commercial applications and do the same thing. And we have engineering staff that I would be happy to have come down and talk with the committee to get into more detail about it. But the thing about these projects is that they make use of waste heat. They have the emission reductions or avoid the emissions that are described on these sheets, that, you know, over 8,000 tons of CO2, over 36 tons of SO2, and over 12 tons of NOx for 1 megawatt of energy that can be produced that way. And because they are located on an industrial site, that means you don't have to build a new facility someplace and go through maybe NIMBY issues, not in my backyard, because you're doing it near a gas pumping station or a paper plant. So you're using it at a brownfield facility rather than a new site. It doesn't have any of the like the bird issues that a wind generator might have and that type of thing. And so those are some of the things I can tell you about it. I got the study a couple days ago. It was completed January 7th, and the engineering department gave it to me. So I've read it, and that's about as far as I've gotten with it. But.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Ms. Hodnick, is this information proprietary? Is it something that you can share at some level with this committee?
We can share. In fact, I have the study actually over with my stuff over there. But we have an engineer, Dwight Anderson, that I work with. He's actually coming down tomorrow to testify. Well, we plan to have him come down tomorrow and testify at a Senate committee. They requested to hear from him, and we'd be happy to have him come and visit with the committee here and talk technically. And he's actually meeting with customers today on a project that we may want to develop with customers, so he could tell you about real life projects that we are exploring with customers in our service territory.
Thank you, Ms. Hodnick, and perhaps we will take you up on that offer and pursue this further at a later date. Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin asked the same line of questions I was just going to ask, and while I have the mic, let me just add my request also that we have this discussion. I think it would be fascinating for us to know about this new clean generation source.
Absolutely. If there are further questions, Representative Kalin.
Thank you. I do have to say, Mr. Chair, that we will discuss this as a committee, but certainly I think the question that will come before us in the next couple of weeks will be whether cogeneration is actually new generation. I think it's fantastic work. I think I'm really excited, and I can't overstate how interested I am in the fact that as a utility you've embarked on this project. I do think we need to have a discussion about whether demand side management and conservation and better use of the better efficiency of the resources coming in is to be considered as part of the standard. Whether hopefully we're at 25%. The question is when. But and so I think it's one of the things we have to consider, both in terms of policy, pragmatism, and then also logic.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that question might emerge, Representative Galen.
I thought I'd just get us chewing on it over the weekend then.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I have two questions related to the current renewable energy that you produce. First is on hydro. I noticed that you have 4.8% of your electricity or your baseload coming from hydro. If you could add more turbines, can you give me an estimation of how many more turbines you could add and how much that would add as far as the percentage?
Ms. Hodnick.
Chair Hilty, Representative Welty. We can add one more turbine, and that's the one that I was mentioning at our Fond du Lac station. It's about 12 megawatts. And so that would be about a 10% increase on our current hydro. And so going with the 4.8%, it would be about half a percent more hydro. That's just an opportunity at an existing station. And there's no other hydro that we could do in our service territory.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more question to follow up. And I was looking at biomass, and you're currently at 0.4%. And that's with 3 facilities online. How many other facilities could you anticipate adding in the future with the waste wood products that are produced up in northern Minnesota?
Ms. Hodnett.
Chair Hilty, Representative. I can't give you an answer to that question right now. We are exploring things with our wood products customers and others to see what we can develop on biomass. But I don't really have an answer for that question. We're very interested in it, again, because it is base load energy and it does match our system, which is, again, why we are interested in waste heat recovery, because it's got steady supply, which we need.
Just a quick follow-up to that. Well, if you could provide those numbers before we get into the issues that we're going to be discussing with the renewable energy mandate, I'd appreciate hearing back from you. Thank you.
And Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard recently that Minnesota Power signed working on another deal. Is it correct with wind turbines?
Chair Hilty, Representative Westrom.
Ms. Hodnett.
Yes, we have just announced a second wind project in North Dakota, a 50-megawatt wind project in North Dakota, near one that just began running at the end of November. So we would have 2 50-megawatt wind projects in North Dakota. By the end of this year, that second one should be up and running. We're also have been actively working on projects on the Iron Range, a larger wind project, and then smaller seabed projects on the Iron Range. And there's also a promising one near the Little Falls area that we're working on with a wind developer that is also a seabed project, but of a pretty good size. So we've got a number of other ones that are in the hopper in various stages of development, but the one you just heard about, Representative Westrom, would be that second 50 megawatts in North Dakota.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative West,
how many megawatts, you said a large project up on the range, how many megawatts is that? And then the other smaller ones you referred to, what are you looking at with those?
Chair Hilke, Representative Westrom, I would say altogether we're probably looking at 80 to 100 megawatts with these other projects that we're exploring. We don't have the other projects firmed up. We're still doing things like looking at wind study data and looking at the economics of those projects. So we don't have firm projects to announce other than the one in North Dakota that we just announced.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Westrom.
Thanks for confirming that, but it does trouble me. Why do we always hear of utilities contracting with some other larger company in another state with some of this development opportunity, because we know those dollars aren't going to turn in our state and in our communities. I'm glad to hear of some seabed projects sounds like you're working on, but it just baffles me every time we keep sending those dollars out of the state. And Mr. Chair, I just note that because I think it's a big part we're going to have to make sure is in any sort of energy bill that goes out, because I think we miss a big opportunity if we let all the next generation of, quote, ethanol, this is kind of the next ethanol phase in our state. If we would let all the ethanol have been produced in other states, we wouldn't have the economic story we've been able to tell. So.
Yeah, I'm sure that we all share that concern, Representative Westrom. And,
Chair Hilke, may I add a comment?
Please.
Chair Hilke and Representative Westrom and members of the committee, I understand your comment about economic development, and I would want to say from Minnesota Power's perspective, we think that in our area, in our service territory, we know there's more biomass opportunity and waste heat opportunity with our industrial operations than there is wind opportunity. That doesn't mean that we're not going to actively pursue, and we are actively pursuing wind projects in our area. But our hope that if we can get biomass projects in particular going, that will aid some of the economic or deal with some of the economic development needs that you're describing and discussing. and, you know, there's more wind available, I think, in the southern and western part of the state than up in our area, and I think there's probably greater opportunities in that part of the state. And so we're focusing a lot on what we have available near us that doesn't require transmission, maybe as much transmission build and that type of thing, so it's an opportunity for us that way as well. So I just wanted to share that insight on the different types of renewable energy and the opportunities they may pose for its utility depending on where it's located.
Thank you, Ms. Osnick. And members, we do have to move on with the agenda. And next up we have Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Mr. Oxley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Greg Oxley. I am the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. We're the trade association for municipal utilities of all kinds in the state, whether it's gas, electric, even water. But I'm going to emphasize mostly electric because that's what the committee's going to be thinking about mostly this year. And in the interest of time, I'll just stick to that. Of the 853 cities in the state of Minnesota, 126 of them own their own electric utility. The people who run these utilities are city employees. The commissions, about half of the 126 are run by commissions that are appointed by a city council, or the city council runs it directly. In a couple of cases, they have a directly elected commission. Our employees, many of them, do nothing but electric work, and in some cities exclusively so, as in Rochester. But in many cases, many of our employees who do billing, administrative work, things of this nature, also have other functions in the city. I hate to use the word synergy, but there are some synergies here that work very well for our communities, and our electric utilities are able to make some important contributions. The largest municipal utility is Rochester, with a population of about 85,000 people and 45,000 customers. The smallest is Wayland, with 60 customers. About 85% of our municipal utilities have fewer than 5,000 customers. 45% have fewer than 1,000 customers, and 20% have fewer than 500 customers. We run the gamut. The average size is about 2,100 customers, and about 2,500 customers and 5,100 people. Our mix is about 265,000 residential customers, 41,000 commercial customers, and 2,600 industrial customers. We serve a total population of 645,000 in the state of Minnesota. We provide about 14% of the electric power in the state. We get our power wholesale from various sources. About 62%, the biggest part, comes from joint action agencies, which are wholesale power suppliers that our distribution entities own and employ. About 18% comes from the Western Area Power Administration, which is hydro plants basically along the Missouri River. These are 47 cities within the WAPA marketing area. And that WAPA marketing area is kind of interesting. Based on a line drawn in 1954, it goes from the extreme northwestern corner of Minnesota down to about Sobieski, and the line goes due south from there through Iowa. And anybody to the west of that line that's a co-op or a muni had the opportunity to get an allocation directly from WAPA. And the rest comes from G&Ts, or investor-owned utilities. I think 10% comes from investor-owned utilities. Because we're city operations, we're about as democratic as you can get. We can't hide anything. We are subject to the open meeting law. We are subject to the Data Practices Act. We are subject to everything. And, of course, for a lobbyist, that's a little scary, but that's the way it is. And actually, it leaves us in a good position because we don't have to hide anything we can't. In terms of municipals, this is the year we're all going to talk about renewables. And I'm not going to go into our renewable bill that we'd like to have introduced, but we're going to have one of our own. We have been talking since August of last year, recognizing that the reality was that this state was going to have a standard, and we had to finally face it. We decided that we were going to come up with the best standard, best rules of the road, as it were, best exemptions that we could find. And we have come to recognize that this is going to happen, and if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. One of the things that scares me more than anything else is what happened in California when they were talking about competition on the local level. Everybody put their aspirations, what they wanted, their wish list, into the bill, but they never took care of how to do it. And they ended up with the biggest self-induced catastrophe in the history of the electric utility industry in the United States. We don't want that to happen. We want to make this work. We don't care where we get our power as long as we can get it. But as one previous testifier said, and I think that this is important, our job is to provide a product 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and we notice that people's tolerance for anything less than that completely dies in about 15 minutes. We're not used to, as a society, not having power. We need juice to run. It's a necessity of modern life. We also have a ton of people that are having trouble paying their bills, so price becomes important to us as well. I don't want to get into the bill that we're going to talk about because you've got a lot of people to testify, and this is supposed to be an overview, but that's going to be the big issue this year, how we do this. And we want to do a good job, and we know that every member of this committee wants to do a good job as well. That concludes my testimony, and I would be happy to stand for questions from members of the committee.
Questions from members? I guess not at this time, Mr. Oxley. We appreciate your testimony, and we look forward to seeing your bill. Next up, we have Mr. Lee Sundberg from the Rural Electric Association. Mr. Sundberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Lee Sundberg, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. And I can't say that, you know, we don't have the open meetings law, but we still don't hide anything, regardless. I'm just going to give a quick overview about the electric co-ops and provide some figures to give some perspective. There are 44 rural electric cooperatives and 6 generation and transmission electric cooperatives providing service in Minnesota. We are a nonprofit, member-owned, one member, one vote, and the members elect the board of directors. The generation and transmission, or G&Ts, provide the power and transmission, and the distribution co-ops provide the local service to over about 715,000 customers, which translates roughly into about 1.8 million people, or 30% of the population. Our service area covers over 85% of the geographic area of the state, and to serve that large expanse requires over 120,000 miles of distribution line, about enough to go around the earth 5 times. The number of customers in each of the co-op ranges from a few at 2,000 to one over 115,000, with a median size of 6,300. Our G&Ts provide about 13 billion kilowatt hours to their members, and this is roughly 20% of the state total kilowatt hour sales. And of the G&Ts, Great River Energy, sitting next to me, Bob Ambrose, is the largest with over 10 of those 13 billion kilowatt hours. We are not rate regulated by the Public Utilities Commission unless the members elect to be rate regulated. But we do come under a good number of the Public Utility Commission, the laws and the rules relating to service, quality and reliability, including the renewable energy objective. Unlike many other states where they have a mandate, not all but many, we did not seek, did not ask for an exemption from the REO when this was under review in 2001. We wanted to work with it.
Generation transmission cooperatives are the renewable energy objective providers. Each G&T is responsible for generating or procuring sufficient renewable energy for the retail customers of their member distribution co-ops. Keeping in mind that the local distribution co-op provides the board members for the generation and transmission co-op. So with the number of electric co-ops or different sizes, different geographic areas, different boards, all lead to numerous perspectives on the issues, and we feel the need for flexibility. And in providing renewable energy, operational requirements and situations dictate, we feel, varied responses. And some of those responses have been very positive, some real positive outcomes. Minn Kota Power Cooperative, for example, in the northwestern part of the state, serves 8 distribution co-ops, has been a real leader in load management and wood waste. And this is a very different response than Dairyland Power Cooperative in the southeast, eastern part of the state, which is a multi-state G&T, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and Minnesota, and they have load management too, but they have manure digesters and landfill gases, and those are very different from Great River Energy, which emphasizes wind, and Mr. Ambrose will be talking about that shortly. Before Mr. Ambrose gives some I'm just giving a quick overview, kind of the broad picture. Mr. Ambrose is going to give the details relating to Great River. But let me give you the 60 seconds, where we're at and looking at this point. Of course, we support the renewable energy objective. We think that's a better vehicle for us in our situation. If there is a mandate, then we look for protections and flexibility of our members, and we can go along with a 20 by 20, that, or maybe even a 25 by 25 if those protections and flexibility is in place. We think a 25 by 20 is too much, too fast. The spikes, the degree of the steepness of the spikes is too much, and we think it's a setup for failure. And we want to try to address the federal hydropower allocation situation, how to count that power. And finally, we feel, and we've been told, that we've been doing an excellent job, that we've been innovative, progressive, that the commissioner, the Public Utility Commissioner, Phyllis Rhea, mentioned in the Senate committee that the co-ops are on the forefront of renewable energy development, and so we think a penalty sends a very negative message in light of that context. Hope that 60 seconds worked. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Sundberg. Questions from members before we go to Mr. Ambrose? Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Ambrose. I'm Manager of Governmental Affairs for Great River Energy. Great River Energy is headquartered in Elk River. We're the second largest electric utility in Minnesota based on generating capacity, which is about 2,500 megawatts. And we're the fourth largest generation and transmission co-op in the United States. Great River Energy provides wholesale electric service to 28 distribution co-ops in Minnesota, 28 of Lee's member co-ops. And one of those co-ops also serves a small part of the northwest corner of Wisconsin. But virtually all of our customers are in Minnesota. Together, those co-ops serve over 60% of the landmass of Minnesota, stretching from the Arrowhead region, kind of surrounding the areas served by Minnesota Power, and going south and west down to the Iowa border. There are areas, kind of the northwest corner of the state is served by Minn Kota Power Co-op, and the southeast corner by Dairyland Power Co-op, and there are a few co-ops served either by East River Power Co-op in South Dakota or Basin Electric in Bismarck, North Dakota. Great River Energy has been providing electricity from wind power since 1998. At that point, we started one of the first voluntary green energy subscription programs in the United States in Chandler in southwestern Minnesota. In 2005, we added a 100 megawatt wind farm at Trimont in Representative Gunther's area, which is the first commercial scale landowner developed wind farm in the United States. As it was developed, it had a lot of characteristics of a seabed project, because when we did our request for proposal, we said we would give preference to a project that was owned by members of one of our co-ops and that was located in the service area of one of our co-ops. But that was before there was a seabed law, and they ended up going to a larger organization for the necessary capital. So it doesn't actually qualify under the definition of seabed, but it's the same intent. That project raised our renewable energy percentage on our system to about 5%. To about 5%. Another 100 megawatt wind project in Maurer County is currently underway. When that project is in place, we will have a renewable energy percentage of nearly 8%. That should be by the end of this year. In addition, we are in final negotiations on a 120 megawatt project that is a seabed wind project in southern Minnesota that should put us over 10% renewables by the end of 2008 or early in 2009. And a lot of the credit for that project being viable should be given to the one-year extension of the federal production tax credit for wind that passed recently. So that is a really crucial factor in successful projects. Since we're one of the fastest growing utilities in the upper Midwest, typically between 3% and 5% growth each year, we will need to continue adding about 100 megawatts of wind each year for the next several years. As you can see by the handout, the blue handout that I passed out, or that the pages passed out, entitled Great River Energy's Future Energy Solutions, we have made a public commitment, and you can find this on our website also, a public commitment to having a renewable energy portfolio of 20% by 2020. We've done the analysis. We're confident we can reach that level. So that's our public commitment on that. You'll also see, by the way, if the second bullet on that commitment piece that I passed out is a commitment to reducing our carbon dioxide emissions to 2000 levels by the year 2020. That will be particularly difficult for us because we are growing so fast. Even with the wind generation that we're putting in, it is going to be a huge task to figure out how to do that. It almost certainly will include some carbon sequestrations or other carbon capture techniques, and we need to figure out how to accomplish that. Our conclusion on renewables obligations at this point, this Great River Energy's conclusions, the conclusion is that we're not particularly concerned whether there's a label of objective or mandate, as long as we're talking about a 20% level. In our view, the difference between objective and mandate is a distinction without a difference. However, we are concerned about how it's structured, what is defined to count toward meeting it, and what else is part of the package. Another way to say that is that the percentage matters, and the pace of reaching the percentage matters. We've also given considerable thought to how to do our part in reducing our impact on the environment. One way is to lead by example, and my favorite example is our new headquarters building that's construction has begun on it in Maple Grove. And for that, please look at my other handout, which has a drawing of it and an article about it. That building, when it's completed, is expected to be one of about 16, only 16 new buildings in the world, and the only one in Minnesota that will receive the U.S. Green Building Council's highest certification level, which is called LEED certification, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, LEED certification at the platinum level, which is the top level. These buildings are more expensive to build at the outset, although you have energy cost savings over their lifetime. We think that tax incentives for LEED certified buildings at some level would be a good idea both for ourselves and for others that, that choose to build these buildings. We have some other good ideas, of course. Among them are tightening the state building code. Another is requiring a certain percentage of high efficiency lighting in new buildings, CFLs and LEDs. We think it would be helpful to people purchasing homes if there was some sort of energy usage disclosure that, made to the potential home owner, expected energy usage, so they can factor in the cost of energy with the other costs of owning the home. We think it makes sense for there to be some sort of state fund to support projects that capture carbon. We also think it's absolutely essential for any sort of renewable energy program in Minnesota. In order to make it work, you really need to have a regional green tag trading program in place so that as one, if one utility is ahead of the curve and another is behind, there can be some trading of credits to make sure that, that we reach the ultimate goal. We also, as others have mentioned, would like to count more of the hydro that is out there, and we would like to continue counting waste energy facilities such as the facility we have in Elk River. Bottom line for us is if the package is right, Great River Energy could support a 20% mandate. And certainly we would like to work with each of you and with the committee to develop a package that does work for the state and for the utilities and for the people and for the environment. So with that, I would welcome any questions that you may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Questions, Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be pretty brief. Mr. Ambrose, you're singing my song on conservation, especially my graduate training is in architecture and planning. So I'm actually working on putting together a bill that addresses a lot of what Great River Energy is doing. So when you're talking building codes and efficiency, I would love to discuss with you further about how to work with utilities to make this really work. Thank you very much for your leadership. And I'm wondering if you would entertain members. Of the committee informally, as your headquarters building goes up in Maple Grove, if we might be able to take a little walk through whether we do it formally or informally.
Mr. Chair, certainly, Representative Kalin. First, thank you for your interest and your professional background. The construction is just gotten underway. There's not too much to see yet, but we can show you drawings, and we can we don't have models, but we have all sorts of drawings, and as things move along, we would certainly welcome any interest or visits by the committee.
Perhaps that'll be an interim opportunity.
That would be. Yes. Thank you very much.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Very quick.
Representative Kalin.
If Mr. Ambrose, if you might also be able to, not today, but in the future, discuss a little bit of the, have some life cycle cost calculations to talk about your decision to, with this building and others, to invest up front to get the savings in the medium and long term. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I could just say very briefly on that, that it was an organizational decision to essentially try to live by example with this new building. What we have decided as an organization is our mission. So we can discuss that in greater length.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we are sort of running out of time here. Representative Wagenius, quickly.
Very quickly, then. Mr. Ambrose?
Mr. Ambrose, sorry. We had
I
overlooked a question.
Okay. I listened to your whole list of things that, you know, are upcoming with you and your commitments to reduce CO2, and I'm going back in my memory, and I had thought that you were part of the group that is trying to build a coal-fired power plant just across the border in South Dakota. Did I have that wrong?
Your memory is correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ambrose.
Representative Wagenius, your memory is correct. We are part of that project. As Ms. Hodnick mentioned, we too have baseload power needs. So we're part of the project.
Representative Wagenius.
My question really is not on baseload or coal, but are you going to be sequestering carbon from that new plant, and are you going to be sequestering mercury from that new plant?
Mr. Ambrose.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I wish I had an answer for that question. The plant as proposed and as approved in South Dakota as part of the overall project, the partners made a conscious and deliberate decision to install a scrubber that would cover the output from both the existing unit and the new unit, and to put in the highest level of pollution elimination equipment that we could, so that as a result, the emissions of SO2, NO2, mercury, the other pollutants, with the exception of carbon dioxide, are at or below, or projected to be at or below, the level for the two units that are currently coming from the one unit. The CO2 issue is a continuing issue. There are hearings underway at through the Public Utilities Commission, as you probably know, and I don't know what the outcome of those will be.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you.
Moving along, Ms. Henkel from the from the Minnesota Utility Investors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm president of the Minnesota Utility Investors. I'm a bit of an interloper today, but I appreciate the opportunity to tell you about a little bit about who we are, and I will be very brief. We are a statewide trade association, statewide grassroots organization of nearly 27,000 members. Our members are the individual who has invested in a Minnesota investor, energy investor-owned utility. We kind of come from the approach to legislation and regulatory process from kind of two different perspectives. Our members are the individual, their customers, the ratepayers, so they are very concerned about cost. Our members are also, though, are the investors. They have invested in these energy companies, and they want the company to remain viable, and they want the company to be successful. They've invested in these companies for many reasons, but predominantly for the dividend. Our members, many of them are retired. Most of them are retired. They're living on fixed income, so cost is important, but that's why the dividend plays an important part of their livelihood. It supplements their livelihood, their fixed income. Our members, many of you have seen them participating in our local small group meetings. They're 60, 70, 80, 90 years old, and they are investors in these companies, and many of them have been investing in these companies for 30, 40, 50 years. They look at it as a long-term investment. Just a few thoughts I want to kind of put out there about the discussion that will be upcoming on renewable energy and how that plays into our members. Our members have invested in these companies but they're all very different kinds of companies. You've heard from a couple of them. You'll hear from one more. They're very different kinds of electric companies in the sense of geography, in the sense of customer base. Some are more residential. Some are, as Minnesota Power talked about, much more industrial focused. That makes a difference. The geography makes a difference as well. And you also heard different variations of growth. Some will anticipate much growth within their system, more customers, and others not as much. That has an impact. So the decisions that you make as you talk about renewable energy, I would just hope, I encourage you to recognize the different kind of companies. And while they are all very different, they have all been making good strides towards meeting the renewable energy objective that the legislature put in place. The Department of Commerce testified a week or so ago, the renewable energy objective is working. That process is working. The companies, the utilities in Minnesota are meeting, if not exceeding, the benchmarks that you established in that process that the legislature established. And we would encourage you to keep that process in place. If the discussion for renewable energy, people want to go further, faster, then let's have that discussion. But we do encourage you to keep the process in place. And with that, again, we'd just like to encourage you, the decisions that you make about renewable energy, please keep in mind that the decisions and the impact they have on these utilities directly impact our members, the individual faces behind the companies. With that, I'll happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Henkel. I do have a question. How many members do you have?
We have nearly 27,000.
And Ms. Henkel, are they all in Minnesota?
No, we actually have members in, we have a few snowbirds. So we have actually quite a few in the southern end of the United States. We have about 19,000, almost 20,000 in Minnesota.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Henkel. And last on the agenda is Xcel Energy. Members, we're going to run over a little bit. I would suggest if you, I don't think there's anything scheduled for this room after 3:45. So I would suggest if you don't want to run over next time, show up on time. And we'll start when we should. Ms. Poffrell.
Thank you, Chair Hilty, members of the committee. My name is Judy Poffrell. I am the Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for Xcel Energy, and I'm very happy to be here today. Xcel Energy is an investor-owned utility. We're headquartered over in Minneapolis. Here in our northern region, we serve a five-state area, and that includes Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, and a little bit over in Michigan. We are a gas and electric utility. We have about 1.1 million customers, about 400,000 gas customers, and we supply about half of the retail electricity consumed in the state. Our electric system is about a 9,000 megawatt system. Just geographically, we are the server here primarily in the Twin Cities, but we also do serve outstate. We serve Mankato, St. Cloud, Winona, and a host of other communities throughout Minnesota. And I do have a handout, if the page could, that does give you some facts about our company, including a list in the back of all the communities we serve. And on top of that retail service, we do serve about 300 wholesale customers through our electric service. We are a growing system. On average, our system is growing on the electric side about 2 to 3% a year. You know, that comes both from economic growth and then also just new applications for electricity, all the things we go home and plug in take electricity, and that is contributing to our growth. We have a diverse supply to meet our customers' needs. Our energy comes from a number of different sources, and we think that is the best thing for our customers, that having a diverse supply mix is important because overall it manages risk and it can help us manage price. If the cost of one fuel input that we use to create electricity goes up, we can switch to another, and we can continually work to balance those things across the system. It's kind of that concept on a very broad scale of don't put all your eggs in one basket. It is helpful, we believe, for our customers to have a diverse supply mix. So those are some of the facts just about who we are and where we serve. What I wanted to talk about with the committee more are some of the things that we're most proud of about our company, some of the things that we've done and where we think we're going. And frankly, in addition to sharing what we're proud of, to basically indicate that the way a number of these things have come to be is through working with policymakers, working with stakeholders, working with our customers to get these things done. And just in addition to being proud of our accomplishment, we're proud of those processes that we have followed. So let me just start with a few, and I'm going to tick off a few, and I am mindful of time, Mr. Chair. I won't try to keep you too long. But let me start with demand-side management, because actually demand-side management, which is conservation and our ability to control our customers' loads when we need to, is actually a very important part of our supply mix. You don't usually think of that as supply because it's basically having a customer not use your supply. But actually, on our system, it's become a very critical and important part of our supply. We spend about $50 million a year on delivering conservation programs to our customers. And they offer, I think, tremendous value for your customers. They help them save on energy. They help us avoid new power plants. They help the environment. It is a true win-win situation. We've worked very hard with stakeholders here to get the regulatory structure for delivering those programs right. Very important that we have timely and adequate cost recovery to allow us to continue to do those programs. But overall, we think they've been tremendously successful. We have saved the equivalent of 5 power plants through these programs over time. And on a peak summer day, the hottest summer days we have at our disposal basically a power plant through our customers' agreements to shed load at our disposal like that. So when it's peaking and everyone's turning on their air conditioners, we can call that load. It's a tremendous resource for our system, saves them money, saves us from building a power plant, saves the environment. It's the classic win-win, and we're very proud of that accomplishment. There are some new challenges ahead of us on DSM, on demand-side management. Sorry to use those acronyms, but there are challenges ahead of us. We have been in this business for a long time. We have achieved much success in our lighting markets and different ways our customers use energy. And as we move forward trying to accomplish more, we need to dig deeper, and we know that. We need to look at new ways to save energy, particularly with our industrial customers who use electricity and processes. We're going to need to partner with them to continue to achieve the same level of the savings and allow that to grow. So we've got challenges ahead, but we are working on them now and look forward to continuing to deliver that for our customers. Let me turn to renewable energy here. Someone reminded me as we came up, I think it was us. I know it was us who was the first wind wind project here in Minnesota, and that was a 25-megawatt wind project, I believe, in the early 90s. And what a long way we have come. Currently on our system, we've got 1,300 megawatts under contract or in the ground already producing energy. And coming out of our resource plan, we have 1,600 megawatts on top of that planned out over time that we will be working to acquire. So what a long way that we've come. And certainly in getting to that point, that has been the result of legislative initiatives that evolved into the REO, but it's also been involved with just the changing economics of that resource. And as we go through the resource planning process that you heard about today, they consider all the available options for meeting customers' needs, and wind has come up, has evolved as a low-cost source of energy. It has its issues, which I know you'll be hearing about as far as its intermittent nature, but certainly it is a valuable energy source for our customers, and we are a growing a purchaser of wind energy. I know you're also aware of the community-based energy development program, and we have been a supporter of this that program. We announced last year our commitment to acquiring 500 megawatts of seabed energy by the year 2010. We've already got contracts with, I believe it's about 150 megawatts. We'll be starting on trying to finish a 300 megawatt commitment by the end of 2007. And then acquiring another 200 megawatts by the end of 2010, or by 2010. So again, that's another route for us to acquire more renewable energy and wind energy on our system. And then lastly, we do have 200 megawatts of biomass energy, which has been more challenging for us to acquire and bring about. But we do have about 200 megawatts of that energy. And again, to get to that point, because we are recognized as a leader on renewables across the country, to get to that point, it has taken the work of many stakeholders and policymakers to create a supportive environment. And one of the things I'll just point out, and it just shows how interconnected our industry is, one of the things that's most supportive of renewable energy was the initiative passed a couple of years ago with respect to transmission that became known as the CapEx initiative, where additional transmission was encouraged to help us be able to bring this kind of energy source to our customers. You know, most of our wind is located out in southwestern Minnesota at Buffalo Ridge. That's not where most of our customers are located. You know, they're located in the Twin Cities, and we have to have a way of getting it from here to there. And that supportive framework of the CapEx model that was adopted by the legislature a couple of years ago is really critical to our ability to continue to grow with respect to wind development. So again, it's a matter where stakeholders got together and worked out a supportive process to allow us to do basically, you know, what we think is the right thing to do on that front. Let me just hit on a couple of things that also I'd like you just to know about with respect to our system. I think you all do know that we are in the middle right now of a major undertaking on our system, which is to install state-of-the-art pollution control equipment on one of our major coal plants. That's the King plant located out near Stillwater. And then we are also in the process of converting two of our coal plants here in the Twin Cities to natural gas. That was known as the MERP project. And through that project, we think we created a lot of benefits, or are creating a lot of benefits. First and foremost is the environmental benefits. But also we're taking these key plants on our system, extending their life, getting more capacity out of them to serve our customers, and again, creating a real win-win. There are costs definitely involved with doing that, but we think it was a good investment, and there are people, a number of people here in this room that helped work to make that happen. So that's a proud accomplishment for us. Trying to work through that same model about how do we creatively meet our needs, one of the things that we've got proposed right now is a new way of meeting baseload need, we believe, which is a combination of a hydroelectric purchase from Manitoba Hydro, coupled with the acquisition of more wind energy. And what can happen is that if the wind is not blowing, the hydro can supply our needs, and over time we can get a more consistent energy source that actually is meeting a baseload need on our system. We've made that proposal to the PUC. We're very proud of it. It's basically an emissions-free baseload project, which is not usually what you get with baseload energy. So we're proud of putting that forward for consideration. And then lastly, we have our upcoming project where we're going to try to take that MERP initiative, which is to clean up and extend the life and get capacity out of our existing resources. We're going to take that model and try to accomplish it at our Sherco plant, which is the largest coal plant on our system located up in Becker, Minnesota. So that's another initiative pending. So you can see we've got a number of key things going on. Our supply mix is going to change. We're trying to change it in a way that's environmentally sound, meets our customers' needs for energy, and still balances the cost issue, because ultimately it is our customers who pay these costs. Very important consideration for us as we move forward. I'll just close with just a couple of points because I know you'll be taking up the RPS issue. And just for a couple of points, for us, you know, the existing REO is a little bit different, and it gets a little tricky because under the existing statute, some of our renewables count, some of them don't. And one of the things that we really think we should take advantage of at this time is to get to a standard, as you consider it, where basically all renewables count, where we can actually take count and take credit for what we have done. And frankly, what's been accomplished here together. And we recognize we're already ahead of the pack. Our standard, you know, as you look at it, can consider that. But we do think we should get to a point where Minnesota can say, this is really how much renewable energy we have on our system, and not have some category that just isn't going to count. To us, that it's time to change that, and we'd like to see that happen. The other thing that we'd ask you to consider as you look at that is that we would like very much to be an owner of some of the facilities that are going to be created as we go to meet this standard. We think that we can be a constructive player in this process. We should be out there working to develop some of these resources ourselves, and we'd like you to consider that because we think that can bring some benefits to our customers. We'd ask you to, again, you know, always keep in mind that one of the reasons we can be successful is because we have supportive regulatory treatment, supportive cost recovery. That is important for us to be able to go out and do these things. Some of these investments total, you know, billions of dollars, and making sure that investment makes sense all around for our customers, for our company, for the environment is an important consideration. We'd ask you to keep that in mind. And then lastly, it's just a matter of being flexible. You know, sometimes as we get into this, and some of it's in existing law, there's lots of real specific, you shall have, you know, wind turbines of a certain size or what have you. And what happens then is that technology overtakes us. And that they aren't the most effective thing anymore, and we're there with a requirement to go get that. And so having some flexibility in our ability to meet it, we think is an important consideration. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will close and answer any questions, but I'm very happy to be here, and we look forward to working with the committee as you move forward.
Thank you, Ms. Balfaro. Certainly, we'll be looking forward to a continuing conversation. Members, if there are any quick questions, this room is scheduled, I think, for the Republican caucus at 4 o'clock. If not, there's a couple of announcements. You will be getting an email about this, but for those of you who are not already aware, we have arranged jointly with a number of committees in the House and the Senate to sponsor a presentation on global warming that will feature Will Steger and Dr. David Tillman from the University of Minnesota. Because of the interest in the subject, and because we're trying to include as many committee members as possible, this will take place next Tuesday, January 30th, at 4 o'clock in the House chamber, which is the only place that we could find that could accommodate the numbers that we hope would be attending. There'll be more information about this emailed to members, but I wanted to give you a heads up on that. And with that, if there is no further business, the meeting is adjourned.